Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. This podcast is also sponsored by DocketWise, an all-in-one immigration forms and case management solution trusted by thousands of immigration lawyers across the U.S. I really like DocketWise. It makes immigration applications easy by allowing the clients to provide information through simple online questionnaires that are shareable by text or email and available in multiple languages. Not only that, DocketWise provides a comprehensive group of case management features, including invoicing and calendaring, secure messaging, task management, and a lot more. You can learn all about DocketWise and receive a 10% discount on your subscription by heading to docketwise.com/immigration-review, so they know we sent you. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. Did somebody say special episode? In this special episode, I interview my partner at KKTP, John Pratt. If you've detected a theme, you're correct. I'm interviewing all of the KKTP partners. I'm blessed to work with attorneys far more experienced and knowledgeable than myself, and I'm doing my best to share some of that knowledge with all of you. John has been with the firm for 2 decades and is the Pratt in Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli, and Pratt. He practices in all areas of immigration with lots of specialties, including EB-5 and related federal court litigation, which he and I take a deep dive into during this interview. Among many credentials, John's active in immigrants lists and is a past AILA South Florida president who regularly speaks nationally on immigration issues. He's also up for election to the AILA National Board of Governors, a fact that I want to be upfront with from the start. While I want to make clear and admit that I don't know much about the other nominees, I agree with a lot of what John wants for AILA National, which he explains at the conclusion of this episode. I leave it to every other AILA member listening to decide whether that aligns with your own values as well. Now, onto the special episode. Thanks for being on the show, John. It's great to have you here. You are now the, let me count, if I include myself, you are the 4th partner at Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt to be on the podcast. How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel great. I feel like the, you know, batter number 4, usually that's the cleanup guy. So, you know, I feel fortunate to be number 4, to be quite honest with you.
That's, you know, I'm not going to lie, that was meant as a challenge to you and you hit it out of the park. You really turned that around on me. My God.
I'm glad I show the value of being the 4th batter in the baseball team.
Thanks for being on the show, John. I'm really happy you are. I'm really happy you took the time.
Thanks for the invite.
It's my pleasure.
And congratulations to you and your show and everything you've done.
Thank you. You know, it's as many of the people listening know, it's a weekly podcast about the case law, and I like to dip my toes into these interviews from time to time, of which I have no real training, but it's fun.
In anything we do, whether it's being attorneys or anything else, you know, we learn as we go and we become better. So, you know, if you don't try to swim, you'll never know if you actually can swim and how good of a swimmer you are. So you got to get wet.
Hopefully without drowning. So, for all the people not from South Florida, who are you, John? What is your background and how'd you get into immigration?
Yeah, well, you know, like a lot of people in South Florida and in Florida generally, you know, we most people are from somewhere else. I was born originally in Nicaragua. Actually have an interesting story in the sense that my my grandfather and my father are American. My grandfather was a Marine stationed in Nicaragua in the 1920s. And, you know, after World War II, he decided to move back to Nicaragua with my dad as a little boy. And my dad grew up in Nicaragua, et cetera. And my father basically was raised, and for all intents and purposes, my father felt, you know, every bit as Nicaraguan as anyone else. Until about in the 1970s, you know, people that know a little bit of Central American history, there was a revolution, a communist revolution and takeover in Nicaragua in 1979. But before that, you know, my father took us out of Nicaragua because it was dangerous. There was a civil war. I did see, you know, events of violence and war and death. And, you know, it was the height of the Cold War at the time. And Nicaragua was really at the crossroads in that Cold War, like Iran, because the two revolutions happened in 1979 at the same time. Initially moved out of Nicaragua into Costa Rica. And I lived in a house with an aunt, and literally we had, you know, I lived in different one room per family. So my family had one room, the Pereiras, which my other aunt with five kids in another room. And we lived like that for about a year. And I thought, you know, I was a little kid. I thought it was amazing because I had all these cousins and, you know, I was in Costa Rica and I would go play basketball. So I actually don't have bad memories of it. I still think it was a wonderful time. I was in Costa Rica. I left with a suitcase, Nicaragua. I remember as a kid thinking, my God, how can I fit all my toys in one suitcase? I mean, can I take two suitcases then?
Right.
Nah, you got one.
So I'm no expert on the subject, but when you talk about the communist revolution in Nicaragua, you're talking about the Sandinistas, correct? And they actually do relate significantly to Iran because they are front and center to Iran-Contra.
In essence, there was an exchange for to provide weapons to what they call the Contras.
The Contras.
Which was the, you know, the individuals that were trying to overturn the Sandinistas by armed rebellion, because the Sandinistas had won. I mean, you know, whoever knows a little bit of history. Again, my grandfather, which goes back to American involvement, my grandfather was in the 1920s a Marine stationed in Nicaragua. Actually, the Marines is the ones that instituted Somoza in the 1920s, the father of the Somoza. Then the Somoza family basically ran Nicaragua up to 1979 when the Sandinistas win. But so my grandfather, and that's why we had to flee, to be honest with you, because I was a descendant of an American. There was a lot of Nicaraguans that felt, you know, for lack of a better word, they used to call us, you know, gringo invaders and whatever. And even though I was born in Nicaragua, and I felt like, why are they calling me that? You know, so, but part of the history of my history and Nicaraguan history was obviously how Somoza was instituted and how he remained in power. And before that, my father used to manage American companies. So they tried to kidnap him. They tried to kidnap my mom and my few of my siblings. So it got pretty dangerous. And just before, you know, they succeeded in mid 1979, in about September 1978, my father took my mom, my grandmother and my siblings out.
Just to wrap up Iran-Contra, so the Reagan administration sells weapons to the Contras to fight the Sandinistas and uses the profits, or tries to use the profits of that money, to pay Iran to get the hostages out. Is that about right?
That's about right. And there was some also connections. If you've ever seen, there's a great movie with Tom Cruise. I'm sorry. So yeah, there's a great movie with Tom Cruise where he's a pilot, where he's moving drugs between Colombia, et cetera. And part of his routes is to deliver arms to the Contras.
Right.
So there was whole a CIA operation on how to buy the arms, what to do with the money, and then deliver the arms to the Contras.
And what you're saying is that Tom Cruise was based on your father, Mr. Pratt?
No, not at all.
I'm trying to get you a gotcha on the podcast.
My father, Mr. Pratt, was you know, he was a happy, you know, American descendant of living in Nicaragua. Now, my dad, you know, because of what had happened in Cuba in the 1960s, just never thought in his wildest dreams that Nicaragua could, you know, that the revolution could succeed. He just never, never imagined in his wildest dreams that he would have to flee. And that's part of the reason why my father never petitioned for me. And, you know, I didn't derive citizenship because my father had moved to Nicaragua when he was a little kid. So he didn't have the necessary physical presence for me to derive it. And because we were living in Nicaragua, you know, he never had a need to petition for us or anything to that effect. I mean, he just never occurred to him that he was not going to live anywhere but Nicaragua until obviously the 1979 revolution.
And I'm sure that there were thousands, if not millions of, I mean, for all intents and purposes, refugees like your family, but because your father was the descendant of a U.S. citizen and therefore a U.S. citizen himself, you guys had this path to come to the United States. Is that about right?
That's about right. Initially, I came with an E2 visa. I came with an investor visa. And once I was here, my dad retained a lawyer and obviously eventually went the immediate relative route. Going to high school, though, being here, growing up in Miami at the time, you know, a lot of my friends, a lot of the people that I was with had immigration problems. So I thought I had the same immigration problem. But, you know, as late as 1992 is when I became a naturalized citizen.
What was it like to grow up thinking you might get deported?
To be honest with you, to some extent, that's why I became an immigration lawyer, because of those experiences. You know, being deported or facing deportation or having the threat of deportation is horrible. I mean, you know, it's something that, you know, unless you live it, it's really just hard to explain. Because imagine just you, every time you get out of your house, you don't know if you're coming back or you don't know if your dad's coming back, etc. And like I said, I was a kid. I never said, oh, by the way, dad, what is our specific status? You know, there's other people going through that situation. You know that you're from the same country that they are, or similar, you know, Nicaragua, Colombia, Panama, whatever it is, Honduras. So, you know, you believe you're in the same situation you are. And you know, I now consider myself lucky and fortunate that I had an easier path. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to become an immigration lawyer. I felt and feel that, you know, immigration for Latinos, for Hispanics, is like our kind of a human rights issue. It's our civil rights issue. I mean, not having the right to live normal and go to work and come back, it's fundamental. And you know, it affects the Latino community in a disproportionate way, I think, in some areas.
That's a good segue, because obviously you've now been an immigration lawyer for many years. You've had a lot of success. You are the Pratt on the Kurzban, Tetzeli, and Pratt. And you've been with the firm, Ira's firm, Ira and Marvin's firm, for a long time now. How long have you been with KKTP? And what were those early years like?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It's my 20-year anniversary on May 1st.
That's amazing, because I'm only 20.
You know, initially I started working previous to Ira. I worked with Magda, Ira's wife, and had been an immigration lawyer with her for about a year, and they used to be in the same building. So I did a little bit of work for Ira while I was working for Magda. And then, you know, I went to work for a big firm in Miami, and I really didn't like it. And eventually an opportunity came up with Ira, and I started working in 2001, 20 years ago. And within the first week, there was a funny story where, you know, I'm leaving, I'm working that first week, literally the first week at 8 p.m. I'm like, my God, you know, everybody told me, man, they're going to work you a lot. Ira Kurzban, you know, he's going to work you.
Right.
And I thought at the time, you know what, it's going to be like the university. I'm going to learn how to do federal court litigation. I'm going to learn how to do some other things. I'll do my stint.
I'll get the hell out.
And learn and move on. Yeah. And I promised Ira at the time, he made me promise him that I would commit to 5 years. So I shook hands, took the job. And the first week I left by error my suitcase in the parking lot. And they start calling my phone number, you know, and I'm like looking at it. Oh, my God, Ira's calling me the first week. It's 8 p.m. It's 9 p.m. I mean, 11:30. These people are really intense. I mean, it's like my fourth day at work. And the next day I hear the messages and it's like, okay, John, someone left a briefcase in the parking lot. Is it yours? And the next one was like, okay, Helena and everybody else has been accounted for. Is this briefcase yours? We're calling the bomb squad. The next call is, okay, the bomb squad is here. We're going to explode the briefcase. If it's yours, you better claim it now. The next call is like, okay, we exploded the briefcase. It is yours. There's documents that corroborate that it's yours. And you got to go pick it up at the police station as evidence. So the next day I go to the police station. Everybody's laughing. They open this box. It's like, you know, dust all over the place. And not to age myself, back then we didn't have smartphones or anything like that. We had something called a Palm Pilot. And a Palm Pilot would have all your contacts, et cetera. This is before iPhones. And it cost me like $400. So I said, Ira, I mean, this is outrageous. You know, can you replace my Palm Pilot? And Ira was like, okay, fine. I'm like, you know, it's not usual that they would call the bomb squad out of work because I left my briefcase, you know. They would just store it.
Yeah, and, you know, that is my question. So, I mean, you know, Magda just came out with a book. She was getting death threats when she went to Cuba and kissed Fidel Castro on the cheek in the 1990s. And Ira's got his history of representing the Haitians and the KKK hating him. But why are they calling a bomb squad to explode a briefcase in 2001?
In retrospect, I guess maybe that, you know, we were ahead of the curve. An unknown briefcase in a building that no one can account for. Let's just call the bomb squad. But I think it was because of the threats and that they had received because of, you know, Magda's thing, et cetera, that comes out in her book. But the bottom line is, yeah. And for a while, a lot of people that knew me, they're like, boom, boom, Pratt. I'm like, okay, guys, thanks.
Boom, boom, Pratt. It sounds like a Black Eyed Peas song. That's fantastic.
Because they blown up my briefcase.
You got that boom, boom, Pratt.
So, you know, that's some people stick. Knew that they had actually blown up my briefcase.
I think you're misestimating the scope of my listeners, John. I think you might have just revitalized Boom, Boom, Pratt
Immigration community.
That's not getting cut. That's awesome. So your first week, you get your briefcase exploded by the FBI bomb squad because you work for Ira Kurzban. That's a pretty nice metaphor for the 20 years to come thereafter. So you were with the firm, got a new briefcase, got a new Palm Pilot, whatever the heck that is. And
you don't even know what a Palm Pilot is.
I don't know what it is. No, I mean, I can imagine. It's very descriptive. So you're with the firm for a long time. You're obviously still here.
No, hey, listen, you know, Ira is a champion. Actually, I'll go back a little bit. My dad managed the Nicaraguan Airlines when I came here. I told you I came on an E2. So, you know, politics in Nicaragua are complex. Even though the communists had moved in, my father eventually had some contacts there and he was able to get a job managing the Nicaraguan Airlines. And one of the pilots of the Nicaraguan Airlines, one of the lawyers for the Nicaraguan Airlines at that point in time was Ira Kurzban. So I met Ira as a little kid. And I remember my dad saying, listen, you see that guy? He is the lawyer of the lawyers. So he's a lawyer's lawyer. He's the best lawyer. So I always like, oh, Ira Kurzban, you know, he's the best. So, you know, when I got to law school, my professor, I had a clinic in immigration law at Tulane in New Orleans, and they're like, okay, the Kurzban book is the Bible for immigration. I'm like, I know Ira. I met him as a kid. So I didn't know he was an immigration lawyer, and obviously, you know, by the time that I was here working in Miami, obviously, you know, everybody working in immigration field since my time to the present, if you don't know Ira, then you don't know immigration. And if you don't read his book, then you don't do immigration law either. That's so, right. You know, it's been a privilege and a fortunate event to work with, work for, and work alongside Ira and obviously, you know, other great individuals, including you now.
I appreciate you saying that, John, and it's certainly likewise. And so you've got an extensive background with the firm, and I know you've worked on every single thing that the firm does over the years. But, you know, on the podcast, I talk about the published petition for review cases. Sometimes I'll dip my toes into a USCIS decision arising in district court, but we've never talked about EB-5s before, maybe in passing with Helena's interview, but you're pretty involved in EB-5. We do mostly EB-5 litigation when it comes to EB-5, but of course we do everything. And EB-5 is not something that many immigration lawyers get into, at least initially. Could you give an overview of what the EB-5 visa is, how you get it, the nuts and bolts, and then some of the stuff we do when it goes wrong?
Let me give you a little bit more historical, because I was initially involved in EB-5 right out of law school in 98. Bottom line, EB-5 is the fifth preference category for employment-based petitions, where a foreign national, initially, they upped the amounts now, but initially at the time was between $500,000 to $1 million, depending on the geographic location and where you invest the money. And in order to increase the number of people that would do that, they created a subsection within the EB-5 category called the Regional Center Program.
What is the Regional Center Program of the EB-5 program?
Initially, when EB-5 was created, the initial envision was, okay, you invest $500,000 to $1 million, depending on the geographic area where it's located. If it's rural or high unemployment, $500,000. If it's any other area, $1 million. And you're going to create 10 direct jobs. That's U.S. workers, U.S. citizens, lawful permanent residents, asylees, working full-time 35 hours at or above minimum wage. That's what they thought. But the program didn't have any traction. It didn't bring the numbers of the people that think. And, you know, for people who don't know, there's a cap of around 10,000 a year on the EB-5 category. And it just didn't get a lot of traction. Different projects tried it different ways, but it just didn't get a lot of traction. Eventually, they created something they call the Regional Center Pilot Program. It was temporary. And then it just got extended for 2 decades, whatever, and they never made it permanent. So that Regional Center Program eased some of the requirements to allow a pooling of different investors and pooling of capital into a new commercial enterprise that could then invest it in a job-creating enterprise. So you could allow this pooling of investors to aggregate the capital and then invest. And instead of having to create 10 I-9, 35-hour human being jobs for qualified workers, they ease their requirements to allow for what they call economic methodologies. And then through economic methodology forecasting to say, okay, if I have $100 million EB-5 capital and we lend it to a Marriott hotel in LA and they combine the $100 million of EB-5 capital with $300 million of additional capital, all of that capital is going to create a hotel for mixed use and 3 towers and whatever, and that's going to create X many jobs. So through indirect job creation, by using these methodologies, you could then satisfy the job creation component of the EB-5. And that's what allowed the program to explode in terms of capital investors.
It's still creating the jobs. It's just in a giant project. It's hard to trace 10 specific jobs to a specific investment, but it's pretty easy to trace hundreds, if not thousands of jobs to many investments. Is that about right?
Let's remember that a lot of these methodologies already used by the government before EB-5 was ever created. Some methodologies were created by the government in order to say, okay, if we have an infrastructure program where we're going to rebuild I-95, how many jobs would it create in the economy? So basically what those forecasting would do is provide indirect job creations through the expenditures. If I buy $1 million cement, well, someone has to make the cement. Someone has to carry the cement. And that economic forecasting tells you roughly how many jobs the capital expenditures created one way or another. You know, indirect job creation basically made it easier for projects and larger projects to be able to be financed and done using EB-5 capital. Fast forward to a few years later, in the beginning of the 2000s, 2003, 2004, it really started getting a lot of traction There was a something called the loan model that was accepted, where you could invest in an entity that could lend money to another entity, and the other entity could use then the money to create jobs, etc. That led to an explosion in the use of EB-5, and that also merged with an explosion on income and capital in China, and that led to a lot of investors from China coming over. Initially, it was Korea. And eventually it was China, but that led to a lot of investors from China coming up in big numbers, where, you know, you had 100, 200, 300 investors putting some serious capital amounts to fund projects. And the regional centers then develop, and different areas develop.
So to put it in practical speaking, to put some images on it, you talk about the regional center program and the numbers. And I know the numbers that you have to invest, they were upped from 500,000 and a million to 1.2 and 1.7 million.
1.8 and 900.
But up until recently, if you were in a qualifying area, you could make a $500,000 investment, and it would provide, in essence, if approved, and it's very complicated, green cards for you and your family to immigrate to the United States, lawful permanent resident status. And
correct. The
$500,000 amount, again, correct me if I'm wrong, is if the regional center is in an underdeveloped, low-income area. And so these areas are mapped out, and say a high-rise in Brickell, if qualified, might provide grounds for a $500,000 investment.
Technically, the term of art is called a TEA. So, and that's, it's either a rural or high unemployment area. But there was some gerrymandering of different sections whereby, you know, you could have a building in Brickell, which is a good area of Miami or Beverly Hills, qualified under the TEA lower threshold because it could commingle other geographic areas in one single unit, and you know, part of the restructuring of EB-5 or criticism of EB-5 was that you know, it didn't lead to the investment that they thought in rural areas or high unemployment areas that they originally anticipated. So you have projects, for example, in New York and in some other states that are would not be readily recognized as a high unemployment area, like Brickell or Beverly Hills.
But it still resulted in significant investment into the United States and significant jobs. I mean, these are real buildings. These are real construction projects in the United States.
Absolutely. And we got to remember other things, which is it's not just the capital that you put to do real buildings, real infrastructure, real whatever. A lot of these individuals were higher net worth individuals. They bought homes. They send their kids to school. They did other, you know, they provided other economic capital and other economic benefits to the communities where they moved and et cetera, because they were highly educated and they had other businesses and they bought other properties, et cetera. So, you know, as an engine to attract capital, as an engine to create jobs, you know, the EB-5 was very successful, but USCIS was ill-equipped to understand some of the nuances of EB-5. And, you know, unfortunately, there were some people that got into it that were less than honest. And it led to problems like J-Peak, for example, which was a Ponzi scheme of a, you know, part of it was tainted in Vermont. And it led to other projects where, you know, either people were defrauded out of outright criminal activity. Sometimes it wasn't not criminal activity, but was just incompetence. You know, you were getting these $100 million loans, and the people that were running the projects were not that business savvy, and people lost their green cards, etc. Because, you know, the important point in EB-5 is you get a conditional green card. You then have to remove those conditions 2 years later. Well, if at the removal stage you discover that, oh my God, they stole the money, or they didn't use the money properly, you may not get those conditions removed. And that's really how we came in. IRA, you know, when I started in 2001, IRA had commenced to start fighting a case called Chang, which is the only precedent decision in EB-5. ever in a circuit court, in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal, on a very important issue, which is USCIS used to adjudicate the I-526 and then somewhat re-adjudicate the I-526 on some of the issues that had adjudicated initially at the I-29. And, you know, that decision basically said, wait a second, you got to decouple that. Once you reach certain things at the I-526 level, like source of funds, you don't re-adjudicate it at the I-829. And, you know, that precedent decision obviously benefited a lot of investors. It dealt with other issues, obviously. I'm just basically giving you a snap. But it dealt also with the cases that they had pronounced in the 1990s, 98, whether they had a retroactive effect or not. So, you know, IRE was already very involved and was one of the pioneers, really, in doing federal court litigation in the EB-5 context. You know, we succeeded in getting that first Chang decision in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that you know, is probably the most important decision in EB-5 to date.
That's very interesting, and I'm not so familiar with Chang. But, you know, I wish that that concept that USCIS cannot re-adjudicate what it's already adjudicated at the next step, that's something that I would very much like to see at the N-400 stage, because as we all know, they are routinely, it's pretty much their bread and butter now, it seems, to re-adjudicate the I-45 adjustment admissibility issue at the N-400 stage. So, I don't know, maybe it's time that we pull from Chang and try and get that done at the N-400 as well. But I don't know. What do you think deference. The prospect?
It'd be difficult, but you know what? I think your podcast is highlighting that some of the great victories or disappointing losses in the federal court. I mean, practicing immigration law means you're dealing with an agency, and that means you're dealing with regulations and you're in a regulated industry. And assuming that the agency is always doing the correct thing is wrong. I mean, that's why we have APA review. Or we have, you know, the BIA and petitions for review, et cetera. I mean, they, you know, a lot of times they get it wrong. So, you know, I mean, the federal courts are there as a check and a balance. And you know, having the ability to go to court, I think it's part of the, it has to be part of the immigration court or the immigration presentation arsenal.
Before I let you go off the EB-5s, I know because we have a case currently pending in D.C., currently, the Regional Center Program, which is essentially the portion of EB-5 that has become EB-5, is set to expire on June 30th. Senator Grassley has a documented history of not really liking the EB-5 program so much. And Senator Leahy, obviously, is from Vermont, where J-PEEC happened, and so he's not so pleased with EB-5 either. What is the future of the Regional Center Program and EB-5 from John Pratt? On May 18th, 2021, what is your prediction?
It faces the first truly existential crisis. Let me back up and simply say this. It's ridiculous that the program was never made permanent because you're dealing with a lot of money. And I think people fell asleep that it would be tied to some funding measures where it would just, you know, people thought it was kind of automatic. The program extension was decoupled from those spending bills, et cetera. So it's a standalone now. The only two bills the bill that needs to be passed to extend it has some restrictions on judicial review, obviously, that would prevent judicial review of these denials that, you know, we've been litigating for over a decade, two decades, basically. And at least that's the only hope to get it extended. And I'm hopeful that Congress realizes the great effect that it would have to people with pending I-526 petitions, that a sunset could mean that they would be denied those petitions, and that it could affect, at a time of COVID, could send ripple effects on the economy, because all those people, I think, would have legal claims to get their money back. And we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars that projects may have to reimburse if those investors no longer have an opportunity to get an immigration benefit out of it and their petitions are denied. So I would hope that Congress does the right thing and extends the program or grandfathers the people that already filed.
So just to be clear, you're saying that in the only piece of legislation currently pending to extend the Regional Center Program, that in large part they're going to provide jurisdiction stripping provisions that make it such that you can't really challenge USCIS denials in federal court anymore?
There's some provisions that mandate that you got to go to the AO. And the current law, there's no exhaustion requirement to have a decision appealed to the AO before you go to a federal court. And so therefore, it's going to restrict it substantially. And we would have to see the devil's in the details in any prospective legislation, obviously, until it's enacted.
Thanks for that, John. Really appreciate it. So, John, before I let you go, as we said at the top of the episode, you are currently running for the Board of Governors for AILA National. I would have everybody on the show, but I don't know them all, so I have you. I wanted to give you an opportunity to tell all the listeners of your AILA members, what are you going to do on the board? Why should they vote for you?
Yeah, let me just give you a little bit of background. Obviously, I've served in the AILA South Florida board for over a decade. I'm former past chair. And when you are a chair of a AILA chapter, you actually serve in the board of governors for that 1 year. And after that, I had done all my volunteering directly to serve for a board or anything like that. And then I was approached by certain individuals on why don't you run for AILA board? And it was 2016. And I served for a 3 year period there. And, you know, it's a large board, it's 80 members. So, you know, each member that gets elected can make change by a vote is just not something that happens in an 80 member board, but you can make changes by voicing certain, you know, suggestions and policy, and you're working different committees, etc. That experience obviously was very helpful. For example, there was issues while I was in the board about the fee structure, that how much to charge members, have we increased it, we haven't increased it, etc. And one of the suggestions that I proposed and backed up is, for example, having a tier system in order that if you are a 1 to 2 year attorney, that maybe you should pay less than a 10-year attorney, because obviously just, you know, in your 10th year of practice, you're probably making more money than in the beginning, and maybe having lower fees as a student. Two main reasons, honestly, for why I'm running. I think that one is political engagement. I think that the work that AILA did with Immigrants List is critical. It's critical going forward. It should not be isolated to just the last presidential election. We have midterms, and we also have AILA local chapters that should be engaged at the local level at all times. Because as we see restrictions in voting suppression or driver's license, then we see how those type of things seep into immigration, whether it's immigration at the local level or at the national level. So I think continuing educating all our members and continuing to push AILA National for political engagement is critical. And what could be some of the results of that political engagement? Maybe having Article 1 immigration courts, you know, so they're outside of political influence and political maneuvering that we saw a lot in the last administration. And the second one is really to add diversity and more inclusion in the board. And that to me takes two things: recruiting from the very beginning in universities to attract them to what AILA can provide, both in terms of professional development and education, and to have different voices, obviously, speak, attend, write, and arise through the different ranks in AILA. I've tried to do that both at the local level, at the national level, and I think that those things are critical. And lastly, education. I think that, you know, AILA needs to continue of something that started in the pandemic, in for example, at the AILA National Conference, that to allow a hybrid where some members that cannot attend because of cost or professional commitments could sign up for some of the classes that they could see in by video or Zoom. And, you know, sometimes you have solo practitioners that simply do removal, and they don't really need to pay for the bundle of some areas that they just don't do. If they want to learn that, for example, an H-1B, because they want to extend the practice, then they could do that. But I think that AILA needs to recognize how to deliver some of the information, the educational materials, or using technology a little bit better. And obviously, hearing from different voices is helpful in such a large member board. No knock on AILA National, but I do think that more geographic and more different voices from different backgrounds is helpful, healthy, and necessary.
South Florida represent.
Including South Florida, to be honest with you. We're underrepresented. We really are.
Thank you, John. Thank you for the insights, and I wish you the best of luck with the election.
Did I get your vote? Did I at least get your vote?
I am the neutral podcast host. I can neither confirm nor deny that. But when is the last day to vote?
So I understand it. I believe voting goes all the way through June the 10th, which is at the time, I believe, is the annual membership meeting during the June ALA National Conference.
Thanks for being on the show, John. I hope your briefcase remains safe and have a great day.
I don't even have a briefcase anymore.
It's been blown up.
It's been blown up.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we do and want to become a patron of the show, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/immigrationreview or click on the link in the show notes. And if you're interested in an official Immigration Review CLE certificate for 5 credit hours, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com with your full name and the episode numbers for the 10 shows you've listened to. Also, feel free to email me with questions, comments, or anything at all. And follow the show on Instagram and Facebook at Immigration Review. And send us a tweet at ImReview. That's I-M-M Review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review.